The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Florence Nash from Triangle Radio Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'm going to be reading to you from a couple of articles from the Internet, then probably a little something from the April-May issue of AARP magazine, and then we'll see how far that gets us. First of all, I'm going to read you a thing that came from the Wharton website of the University of Penn Wharton School. This is called The Retirement Problem. What will you do with all that time? Before I start, let me remind you that today's programming is generously underwritten by Salibi Chiropractic. Salibi Chiropractic welcomes the geriatric community with any neck, back, or hip issues. You can call them at 919-782-4733. Again, that's 919-782-4733. And now to our reading. The Retirement Problem. What will you do with all that time? You're excited about retirement, right? You've worked hard for, what, 4 or 5 decades now? You're due. No more early alarm, no more meetings, no more deadlines, no more office politics. Can you believe it? It's just you. Out on the links, puttering in the garden, taking care of your grandkids. It's going to be great. Except what if it's not as you pictured? What if those things you've looked forward to all these years, more time for your hobbies, more time to travel, and more time to relax, aren't enough to sustain you? What then? Even soon-to-be retirees with big plans for the next chapter of their lives often harbor big doubts about what comes next, according to Stuart Friedman, practice professor of management at Wharton and founding director of the Wharton Work-Life Integration Project. The questions people ask at earlier stages of life become more profound at these later stages, he says. Am I living the life I want to live? What is most important to me? Who is most important to me? You see the end, and so you think about what you want to do with the time you have remaining. There is the question of, now what? Research indicates that those who are happiest in retirement tend to answer that question by giving back and discovering a sense of purpose. While giving back can mean boosting charitable contributions, for a growing number of retirees it often comes in the form of a significant volunteer position or encore career, notes Friedman. The most successful people in retirement look to use their talents and passions to make a contribution, he says. Figuring out how exactly you'll make this contribution and how you define your sense of purpose is the tricky part. Some introspection is in order. It's critical to reflect on what matters to you, says Friedman. People at this stage are focused on their legacy. You need to actively inquire of yourself, what do I want to leave behind? The great paradox of the golden years is that there is so much time and yet so very little of it. Retirement, after all, signals the final stage of life. It typically happens after 40-plus years of work, after your children are grown, and after your house is paid off. As a result, retirement is often a time when a person contemplates his or her mortality, says Jack Guttentag, emeritus professor of finance at Wharton, who is 92. When people reach the later stages of life, the realization that their lifespan is coming to an end may generate some anxiety, he says. You always knew, intellectually, that life was short, but during the years when you were building a career and a family, the emotional recognition of that fact was kept at bay, he continues. When the realization that you will soon cease to exist finally comes to call, the response can range from disabling to total equanimity. The end may feel near, but in fact, for most people just starting to collect Social Security, there is still plenty of life to be lived. As people lead longer and healthier lives, a person retiring from full-time work at the age of 65 today will likely live another 20 to 30 years. That time horizon is daunting for many people, says Kevin Reardon, owner and president of Shakespeare Wealth Management in Pewaukee, Wisconsin. There's often a combination of excitement and anxiety as people approach retirement, he says. The excitement comes from having more free time, but anxiety comes from figuring out how much can I afford to spend and what will I do with all that time. The two are related, but money is the most practical concern. Many prospective retirees have deep-seated worries about having enough money to maintain their lifestyle in retirement, and for good reason. The latest household survey conducted by the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System found that as of 2014, about 31% of Americans have no retirement savings or pension at all. According to the latest Retirement Confidence Survey from the Employee Benefit Research Institute, EBRI, Americans' faith in their ability to retire comfortably, which languished at record lows between 2009 and 2013, the crisis years, has rebounded but is still quite low. Nearly a quarter of American workers say they are not at all confident they will have enough to be comfortable. Retirees are less sure of what their retirement income is going to be, says Chris Geshe, an adjunct professor of finance at Wharton and the academic director of the Wharton Wealth Management Initiative and the Jacobs Levy Equity Management Center for Quantitative Financial Research. And yet, he says, money is not the panacea for successful retirement. Having enough of it so that you are buffeted against antagonistic states of nature, an economic shock, say, or a health scare, that's important, but there's more to it than just money. In other words, people approaching retirement need to have a financial plan, but they also must have a plan to stay engaged and productive. Your psychic value and your economic value are correlated in our society, so find ways to protect both leading up to retirement, says Greshy. Aging well and aging gracefully are part of the goal. Aging well and gracefully in retirement may be the goal, but getting there is often a challenge. After all, it can be traumatic to leave the working world, particularly if your self-concept is wrapped up in your job. You might feel a loss of importance and a loss of vitality. You may grieve the loss of friendships. A lot of people get their identity from work, and they get their social interaction from work. So the idea of stopping means they're going to lose both, says Peter Capelli, professor of management at Wharton and the director of the school's Center for Human Resources. You need to respect that it's going to be a huge loss. If you're getting close to that part of your life and you don't know what you're going to do, treat it as a worrying sign, he adds. Don't assume it's going to be okay and that it's all going to work out. Figure this out now. Get busy. The first step is self-reflection. Start by doing a realistic assessment of what you enjoy about your job and what you stand to lose by retiring. On the one hand, you may feel ready to leave the working world, but on the other hand, as the reality of retirement takes hold, you may feel restless and uncertain. Consider, too, how you will spend the 40 or 50-odd hours a week you previously spent at your job. Do a mental exercise, suggests Capelli. Let's say the office is closed for a week. Ask yourself, what are you going to do with all that extra time? If your answer is, gee, I have no idea, think about your interests. Think about your hobbies. Think about what you like about the work you do and what kinds of volunteer opportunities appeal to you. It's useful to know yourself. Dig deep, says Amy Jo Lauber, a financial planner in West Seneca, New York. Think about organizations you feel strongly about. Ask yourself, is there a part of the world I want to make better? As you're making a list of potential opportunities, seek out courses and programs that might be useful to you in this new undertaking. In the years leading up to retirement, it's wise to invest in activities, relationships, and expertise, according to Sana Sato, the president of a financial advisory group in Minnesota. The thing is, no one really knows how he or she will feel once retired. Before retirement, it's all hypothetical, he says. But one of the biggest challenges is when there's a gap between expectation and reality, Asato adds. You take a busy executive who has had a successful career. He is looking forward to retirement because he wants to pursue a hobby or some kind of pet project. But when he retires, he finds he is not very good at it. It's difficult. I encourage my clients to take classes, take lessons, brush up on their skills while they're still working. If you still need time to figure out how you want to spend your retirement, or, indeed, you still need the paycheck, consider a phased retirement, which involves working a part-time schedule while beginning to draw benefits. Many companies, including Intel and Cigna, have programs that allow older employees to scale back on a contract or freelance basis, notes Wharton Scapelli. The workers have the same status and they pretty much work in the same groups they did before, but they do not supervise other employees and they have no administrative responsibilities, he says. The benefits of these gigs are myriad. You stay socially engaged, your mind stays more acute and alert, and you have ample free time to explore other opportunities. The additional income doesn't hurt either. You're not getting out, you're tapering down, Capelli says. Then again, you may already have your sights set on your next endeavor. Perhaps it's a cause you're passionate about, be it disaster relief, autism awareness and treatment, food insecurity, or your local school. Perhaps it's a continuation of a professional pursuit that involves tackling a problem in a new light. Perhaps it's a venture that uses your hard-earned skills in a new domain. Your idea already has a name, Encore Career, a job that blends personal meaning, continued income, and often involves some element of social impact. Research conducted by the consultancy Penn Schoen Berland on behalf of Encore.org and the MetLife Foundation suggests that as many as 9 million Americans aged 44 to 70 are engaged in post-retirement careers, and another 31 million Americans want to pursue an Encore career. According to the research, Encore careers, also known as post-careers or second acts, tend to provide more satisfaction than previous careers. People in Encore careers express very high job satisfaction, and overwhelming majorities say they feel good about the work they're doing. See the positive results of their work, know that they're making a difference, feel appreciated, and like that they're able to use their skills and experience, note the study's authors. While Encore careers are not solely in the realm of the nonprofit world, the findings align with similar research on the benefits of volunteering. According to a study by Merrill Lynch published earlier this year, retirees who volunteer have a stronger sense of purpose, higher self-esteem, and are both happier and healthier than those who do not. It's not surprising that people engaged in Encore careers feel energized by them, says Friedman. They're using their human capital, the knowledge and experience they've developed over the course of their lives and their careers, combined with their social capital, who they know and the connections they've made, to make the world a little bit better. Jack Gutentag, the retired Wharton professor who still works full-time, is one of the ultimate examples. What he's doing now in his so-called retirement years is not all that different from what he did as an academic and a researcher. He's working on an internet-based calculator that makes it easier for retired homeowners to assess whether or not they would profit from taking out a reverse mortgage. This was one of my earliest academic interests going back to the 1970s, but today we have computer-based tools and the internet which permit entirely new approaches to the topic, he says. Gutentag is philosophical when it comes to describing how he arrived at his current career. The least successful people in retirement are those who hated what they did to earn a living and looked forward to a retirement when they could begin to do what they enjoyed. The most successful are those who loved what they did during their most productive years and continued their involvement with the same or closely related activities, possibly at a reduced scale, as they became older. A third group had rewarding and productive careers, which they were forced to terminate on retirement, at which point they switched to a new activity, he continues. How well they do depends heavily on how early they had begun to engage in what was to become their major post-retirement activity. But in the end, says Lauber, the financial planner, there is no one-size-fits-all solution. There is no one formula. Retirement can take a lot of shapes. There's a lot of different ways you can be successful in retirement. Now, let's look at some reports from people who move into new things in the later stages of their life and are having a wonderful time. Here's a couple of entries in the Personal Best section of AARP magazine, the April-May issue. 50 Reasons to Love Being 50 Plus. So let us take, first of all, personal best, my dream, peaking at the right time. Winemaker Mary Edwards waited decades to be the big boss. When I was a physiology major at Berkeley, I brought home fruit from orchards in the farmer's market. At the end, they gave away what they couldn't sell and made wine from it. My friends always wanted to drink the wine while it was still fermenting. They would drink anything. I was quite the popular girl. After college, I decided to attend the Enology graduate program at the University of California, Davis. There were no female students before I entered the program, and when I started applying for jobs, I couldn't get hired, even though there was a big demand for winemakers, and I was a top student. I don't think they believed a woman could do the job. When I was eventually hired to run a 25-acre vineyard and winery in 1974, I threw myself into it. I did everything, even lifting barrels over my head. I ran the winery as if it were my own, which set the tone for my career. But I never imagined I would be able to afford my own winery. I met my husband on a Grand Canyon rafting trip to celebrate my 50th birthday. I was just forming a company to produce wines in Sonoma County. He was interested in wine and had a background in agriculture, so we had a lot to talk about. He and his son and brother soon migrated over to my raft, and we spent a lot of time together. When the trip was over, and maybe this was a come-on, he asked to attend one of my new company's planning meetings. He's been a partner ever since. We made wine and rented facilities for 10 years and did well enough that we eventually had the funds to build our own winery. We started making wine there even before construction was finished. People would ask me, "How can you deal with the chaos?" I told them, it's my chaos. Like a wine that has aged, I think I'm more complex today. I couldn't even read a balance sheet when I established the business, and now I have 24 full-time employees, and we produce about 28,000 cases a year. I think my most important job now is to be a role model, especially for young women, and I want to keep improving on my wines. I think about that goal all the time, at work, at home, even while doing yoga. There's no end to the challenge of winemaking, which makes it as much fun as it was when I was doing it in college. Mary Edwards, 70, is the proprietor of Mary Edwards Winery in Sebastopol, California, and an inductee of the Culinary Institute of America's Vintners Hall of Fame. Now, Mary gives us a few tips on her favorite wine pairings. Choosing the right bottle can bring out the best in a meal. For red, hardy Pinot Noir and Cassolet. The tannin and acidity of a big Pinot marry beautifully with the rich, savory nature of a Cassolet, especially one made with lamb. For white, Sauvignon Blanc and chicken noodle salad. The floral notes in Sauvignon Blanc really pop when paired with a light, citrusy dish, such as an Asian-inspired noodle salad. And for bubbly, sparkling rosé and mushroom tart. The fruity, creamy qualities of a fine brut rosé sparkler bring out the earthy richness of a mushroom main dish. Now we have personal best, my art, Paint It Forward. Editor M. Stephen Doherty found new inspiration by going outside. Mr. Doherty, who's 70, edits Plein Air magazine and is the author of The Art of Plein Air Painting. He writes, 30 years ago, when I was working and raising a family, I complained to a fellow artist that I was too busy to finish any paintings. My friend suggested I try painting outdoors. He told me that plein air painting can complete a respectable small painting. He told me that plein air painters can complete a respectable small painting in 2 hours or so and can work wherever they happen to be. My pal and I met in a local park where he showed me how to use lightweight portable equipment, a limited number of paints, and just a few brushes. With these tools, I realized I could paint on business trips, at kids' soccer games, or during family vacations. I bought the recommended supplies and ventured out locally, where I discovered some challenges I hadn't anticipated. Bugs, sunburn, sudden downpours. But I also discovered some unexpected benefits, starting with the fact that my outdoor paintings became like sensory time capsules for me. Looking at one, I could remember everything about the day it was painted. Another benefit was that working in this way, limited by the changing light and my minimal supplies, created an unusual sense of focus. While painting, I felt separated from every other daily concern. Over the intervening years, plein air painting has become more popular in the U.S. Now there are festivals and paint-outs around the country. There's even a national magazine about it, Plein Air, and I should know because I've been its editor-in-chief since 2011. I started painting outdoors as a way to finish artwork during the busiest time in my life. Now I do it because it allows me to express my personal connection to nature, and rather than grab a few moments, okay, hours, to make a painting when I can, I plan my days and weeks around good weather forecasts and the availability of friends who like to paint outdoors, too. Sharing this pursuit with others is my way of honoring the friend who introduced me to it. In my younger days, he heard my frustration and offered a solution that's lasted a lifetime. Now, here's one more personal guest, my skillet dinner. Shrimp Confidential. Chef Zarella Martinez whips up a seafood dish that tastes of taboo and of love. Zarella Martinez, who is 70, is a cookbook author who for many years owned a restaurant, Zarella, in Manhattan. On our family's ranch in Sonora, Mexico, I grew up cooking, smelling, tasting, inventing, experimenting. My mom always said, you have to prepare food with love, otherwise the food resents it. She taught me that treating food with respect comes from the same place as treating people with respect. I've tried to bring that warmth and sense of hospitality to my whole career as a chef. When I was about 11, I asked my mom, why did you name me Zarella? Why couldn't I have a normal name? She said, because it's going to look good in lights, honey. I was a tomboy, a mess all the time, riding my horse, Desprezio, through hills and canyons while singing my mom's favorite songs. I don't know what she saw in me, but she saw it. So she and my dad spent a lot of time developing my mind. After college, I spent 2 years on the ranch with my dad, going through gourmet cookbooks like Helen Corbett's. We ate Mexican food at lunch and continental at night, at our beautiful table with linen and with blue dove china and plastic flowers. At 7,000 feet high, there were no real flowers. Then I went to El Paso, Texas as a social worker, got married, and had twins. I started cooking for friends because I needed extra money. That's when my mom said, you have a real talent for this. I'm going to give you your inheritance now so you can study cooking. She sent me to a Beverly Hills caterer who taught me the business and the importance of creating a distinct style, an identity. My mom and I started to research Mexican cuisine. Tex-Mex was the rage then, but the cooking I grew up on was very different. It was regional and included strong influences from Spain, such as the olive oil and garlic in my recipe for camarones al ajillo, shrimp in garlic sauce. Whenever I make this, the smell of olive oil, garlic, and chilies takes me back to the ranch. My mom and I found the dish in a wonderful seafood restaurant in Mexico City called Pardinos, and I immediately fell in love with its exciting combination of flavors. But there was something we couldn't identify, and we could duplicate anything. So we went back a few times. Money talks. We finally gave a waiter 100 pesos, a lot of money then, to watch the chef and tell us what he used. The secret ingredient was powdered consommé base. He heated the oil and garlic, put in some of the base, then added the chilies and shrimp. That was the elusive flavor. The secret ingredient was the humble bouillon cube. It horrified food purists, I later discovered, when one national food magazine did a feature on me. The staff refused to print the recipe with the powdered consommé base and substituted a reduction. They boiled a tankful of chicken stock down to 2 tablespoons. Ha! The flavor was acceptable, but not the same. My mom took me all over Mexico and traveled on her own to find recipes. She discovered a little bar in Veracruz with many snacks, botanas, but they didn't let women in. So my stepfather brought out all the botanas and beer. That's where red snapper hash, another of my signature dishes, comes from. My mom's research helped create my distinctive identity in cooking. But I think the most important thing was she taught me to treat people and food with love. Let's see if we got time to fit in one more. Here, personal best, our cause, a place for all. Pastor Larry Stoss and his wife Kathy create community one meal at a time. Larry says, "We've lived in Portland, a neighborhood in Louisville, Kentucky, since 1999. The neighborhood has beautiful architecture and deep heritage, but it has experienced many of the challenges faced by a lot of urban neighborhoods. Disinvestment, interstate cutting us off, migration to the suburbs." Kathy says, "We didn't have a single sit-down restaurant that wasn't fast food, and our neighbors wanted one." Larry says, "I'd been working at a United Methodist Community Center. In 2012, we planted a church in an old warehouse building, and that building is where we opened the restaurant, The Table, in 2015. It's a nonprofit that's separate from our church, but a lot of our members have been involved. The prices on the menu are just suggestions. You pay what you can, or you can pay by volunteering, or you can pay extra to help someone else afford a meal." Kathy says, "We're primarily run by volunteers. Our co-founder, John Howard, has been with this effort from the very beginning. He's a volunteer. He and our chef, Laura Roundtree, have created a menu that's tasty and uses food from urban gardens right here in Portland." Larry says, "I love the Parmesan fries. I remember saying once, I could eat these Parm fries every day. And then I said, oh, I do eat them every day." Kathy says, "Then I said, you have to quit eating those fries every day." Larry says, "There's a lot of diversity among our clientele. When you see someone eating here, you don't know whether this person is from downtown or from under the bridge. People from all walks of life are enjoying meals together. There's a lot of dignity in that." Larry, who is 60, is the pastor of Louisville's Church of the Promise United Methodist Church, where Kathy Stoss, 61, serves as the volunteer coordinator. It's about living, not aging. If you knew you were going to live to be 100, what would you do differently today? That's the opening challenge from AARP CEO Joanne Jenkins in her bestseller, Disrupt Aging, A Bold New Path to Living Your Best Life at Every Age, out in paperback. This update looks at the opportunities that come with huge numbers of us living longer, with far-reaching implications no matter our age. Find Disrupt Aging wherever books are sold and at disruptagingbook.org. And now I see that the clock is running down on us, and we're just about out of time for today's episode of Modern Maturity, but I do hope you'll come back and listen next time and that you've enjoyed this today. I'm Florence Nash, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and our programming today is generously underwritten by Salibi Chiropractic. Salibi Chiropractic welcomes the geriatric community with any neck, back, or hip issues. Call 919-782-4733. That's 919-782-4733. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, do give us a call at 919-832-5138.